renew acquaintance with somebody that I hadn't seen in a great long time. Now, just because that didn't work out doesn't mean necessarily that it wouldn't work out in other circumstances. So another kudo for Sunstone. Anyway, without further ado, let me turn the time over to John Flynn, Church in the State of Utah.
In Utah. Of Utah.
Rod asked me also to extend his apologies. His dad is quite ill, and he's with him in Nevada. So, well, thank you for the invitation to speak at the Sunstone Symposium on the question of church and state. I claim no expertise in the topic, other than an abiding interest in the legal and political life of the state, its history, and the events over the past almost four decades I've lived here. Early in my mission to Utah, my mission from Boston to bring proper pronunciation of the language to the West, I developed a fascination with the historical, the political, the religious, and the legal development of church-state relations in Utah. You can hardly avoid it, particularly if you're what I call a non, a person not a member of the LDS Church, much less if you're a native and a member of the LDS Church. There are other categories of nons in Utah, and one that is becoming, I think, more and more prominent in recent years, and that is the political non. Utah has become a one-party state, overwhelmingly so, and one where those who don't adhere to the beliefs of the majority party often consider themselves excluded from most of the decision-making that goes on. They are persons, I think, who also believe they're ignored in the process, as witness our last legislative session. So public debate between opposing political parties seems to be more muted in Utah than when I first came here 38 years ago. And almost all the major offices in the state are in the hands of one political party. There's also been another development I've noticed, and maybe it's just my impression, and that is that there's becoming a stronger and stronger identity between the Republican Party and the LDS Church in the minds of many, which I think creates subclasses of nones. First, the non who is both a Democrat and not a member of the LDS Church, and then a non who is a member of the LDS Church and a Democrat. So we have a lot of categories of nons around. The one class I would like to speak about are the real nons, the pure nons, namely those not members of the church and those who are either liberal or Democrats in their political views. Those nons, I think, are becoming increasingly paranoid and cynical and upset. And that's a dangerous situation. They believe or assume that many public issues are determined by either the church in favor of the party or the party in favor of the church. And they often do it without any hard evidence that that's the case. They have some reason to believe that some decisions may be made in some cases, but by and large, the assumption is almost automatically leaped to, whether it's the buying of a city block in the city, or the mining of a quarry, or the closing of a swimming pool, that there's somehow a mixture of church and state that is taking place. Government persecution because of religious beliefs dominates the history of the people of this state, and you find issues of church and state here that are matters of passionate concern in Utah. And you see articles in the daily press. Often they have a church-state slant, whether it be the closing of a swimming pool on Sunday or the process by which the terms and conditions of the sale of a city block for a park were somehow arranged, how much granite can be removed and so on. Usually you'll see a church-state slant to those kinds of issues in Utah. One only needs to read the letters to the editor. I am surprised, since I read newspapers quite religiously all over the country, to realize that issues of church and state are very important in Utah, and they're very divisive. I've never seen anything like the number or the anger you see on both sides in the letters to the editor columns of our local newspapers. That in D.C. and I think other recent developments indicate that questions of church and state in Utah really are bubbling quite strongly below the surface, and they're creating a tension and a division in the community, possibly one that might rise to unnecessary and unfortunate levels. The involvement of the LDS Church with government in Utah and elsewhere, whether it should be involved, whether it has been involved, and whether it is now being taking place, I think are all matters of great concern to nons, the classic non. It's difficult to be a non and demeaning to be called one in any society, particularly where the overwhelming majority of the people living in that society are of one religion, where the overwhelming majority of the officials in the state or the government are of that religion, and where you have an overwhelming number of the religion belonging to a single political party. It's come to mean, I think, the denial of existence for many of the nones in this community, not just people that do not share membership in the group. Many nones assume and therefore believe that there's a growing pattern of dominance between the LDS Church and the state without any evidence to support it. More importantly, nones believe that those with political power are acting without following proper processes for making decisions which affect the public. And it is not a healthy thing for a community, for its political and religious leaders, to be perceived as ignoring or failing to hear the concerns of nones in that community or tolerating their exclusion from political life. A state or a community where political life is dominated by one political party and or one religion with strong moral and political views courts risk by virtue of the dominant ignoring or even worse not hearing or seeming to care about the views, the concerns, and the rights of nones in that community. Public's business can be done without consulting nones or in secret by a handful of leaders oblivious to the interests of others. It has long been so in relatively small communities. I grew up in a small community where three or four people decided everything. Since all of us belonged to the same group, church, and so on, nobody really cared. But when a community grows and when it becomes more diverse, then you run risks with that kind of decision-making process. Actions like those which have pervaded recent sessions of the legislature, where most of the significant decisions like budget issues, passing a law permitting someone to run for two national offices at the same time, and restricting the powers of the elected attorney general were made in secret Republican caucuses and quickly passed over the objections of many. The political minority is often considered to be so minor that it can be ignored without thinking about the consequences of doing so. The effort to bring the Olympics to Salt Lake City, for example, took place in less than a public and open way, and it was done largely by local power brokers doing what they thought necessary to win the bid. Those managers of the bid apparently believed, after losing prior attempts to win the games, that the ends justified the means in the corrupt process of designating Olympic sites. There was little need for public debate or full disclosure of what was going on when those who knew best decided what was best for all of us. Like sheep, the rest were simply expected to go along and be grateful for Utah finally emerging from its self-imposed inferiority complex. That's the process or a process of secrecy that's bad. And if that exists anywhere in your political or social decision-making, the community runs serious risks. Now, many citizens, religious nones, and good church members, and I think the church itself, doesn't know what to think of the Olympic affair since public knowledge and public participation was not sought, although because we probably assumed it wasn't needed. Citizens left in the dark now attribute some of the actions in securing and managing the Olympics to less than worthwhile ends and may be left paying for losses that they had no part of incurring the failure to follow a proper process, a due process for all members of the community, nons and non-nons, may well have undermined the effort for many in Utah to hold the Olympics, whatever its merit. Those who are political, religious, economic, or social nons excluded from a decision-making process quite naturally take exceptions to the decisions made in these ways and by people they believe don't represent them. They think they ignore their concerns, even if they're invited or if they're permitted. Those often excluded make assumptions, usually not true, just make assumptions, leap to assumptions, attributing the decision made to inappropriate interference by a dominant religion or dominant political party, ignoring proper processes and doing things in secret. For example, in some circles, there are now nons who call the Salt Lake Olympics the Mormon Olympics as a result of the way a new person was selected to run the Olympics, and another was selected to manage the day-to-day affairs of the Olympics. And even though the LDS Church had little to do with either promoting the idea or selecting who obviously is a good candidate to manage the Olympics, assumptions to the contrary now pervade the world of many nons because of the process and because of the importance of the decision that was made. Many believe arbitrary political retaliation by the Republicans is behind the legislation stripping the Democratic Attorney General of significant powers of the office. The law doing so was adopted in the secret caucus. It was run out on the floor and passed within a week. There was little debate within the legislature. There were no adequate hearings. There was no notice to the public, and it was done by a strict party line vote. Struck me like I was back in Boston, way back when. The matter is aggravated in the minds of many nons because of the present incumbent is assumed to be a non. And some believe it may have been in retaliation for stands taken by the Attorney General on issues like refusing to file a brief in a Vermont case on the same-sex marriage issue, and others who believe that it's really a move to centralize even further political power in the hands of the Republicans, the governor, and indirectly the LDS Church. I've heard them say so, and these are reasonably well-educated, intelligent people. The sale of an important city street to the LDS Church appears to have taken place without a great deal of public notice or a full disclosure of the consequences for the park that was going to be created and claimed to be a public park. It's not quite as public as other parks. While it might be good policy, and frankly I think it is, to ban automobiles in the central part of a city and create more green space, even if it means Temple Square is converted into Temple Rectangle, the process by which that decision was made, this process by which it was done, and the undisclosed grant of power to regulate dress and conduct within the park infuriated many. And when I say infuriated, I mean infuriated. It didn't help much when earth-moving equipment began to work on the project within 24 hours of the divided city council vote, selling the block with restrictions on further or future public use. And it was a vote that was widely noted to be a divided one. It was divided on religious grounds, not political ones. It appeared to be a deal locked in long before any public debate or opportunity to review the conditions of the sale and the conditions of the use to be made of the property were made. Only in Utah are official celebrations of our national holiday commemorating the 4th of July held on the 3rd or the 5th. Many religious nons assume that decision was made by some unknown power in the community. Suddenly, the 4th of July was no longer the 4th of July to them, but it was done for some religious purpose, perhaps the right of the majority to celebrate the Sabbath in the way they normally choose to celebrate it, if not the way others might choose it. Public swimming pools in some communities are suddenly closed on Sundays, Even though those who paid for them enjoy using them on Sundays, not much public debate involving all members of the community took place in some of these instances, and it led to a great deal of bitterness, divisiveness, and now bigotry. The nones remained cynical and angry about the justifications given for doing such things. The sale of alcoholic beverages by the bottle continues to be socialized and tightly regulated in a place where the free market is venerated and government is not. And although school credit is no longer granted for seminary classes, release time is, and it is an advantage enjoyed primarily by LDS students who have seminaries built next to every school. The lack of competitive and public debate about some of these issues, like the lack of competition in the economic sphere, results in mistakes being made, sloppiness in the decisions made, the ossification of process, and better alternatives not considered. A process ignoring the religious and/or political minority promotes divisiveness in the community, bigotry, and the alienation of those not involved from supporting any of those decisions that were made. The alienation of Utah's religious and/or political nones is, I think, one that poses a very serious risk for the dominant religion here, the church, for the state, for the community, and for our education, for our business and other institutions necessary to have a civil and progressive society. Attracting businesses and valuable individuals who will make a significant contribution to the community becomes difficult, as does retaining those who are already here. I am hearing more and more people responding, if you don't like it, leave. I hear them leaving. That is not healthy. The building and maintenance of community made up of citizens with trust and respect for each other becomes even more difficult. An education and the leadership of a citizenry with open minds and the capacity for self-reflection and moral growth might well become impossible because of this loss of diverse views and competitive debate. There has come to be an assumed identity of church and political party in Utah by many nones, church members as well, and people around the country. And it's an identity which I think is promoted by a very aggressive conservative wing of the Republican Party. One party dominance and the association of that party with the dominant religion in the public mind, whether it's intended or not, have been and continues to be a source of division among many in this community. Dominance in political decision-making and ignoring nones, both political and religious, has these consequences without regard to the extent to which the dominant religious group or the dominant political party formally tries to do it. It's automatically assumed it is happening, in large part, again, because of a lack of process and a lack of stopping, thinking, and saying, well, let's have some debate about this and let everybody state their view. The cause of bigotry is ignorance like that displayed by a public official attributing the high moral standards of her local community to the fact of how few non-Mormons live in that area. Or those nones, one of whom assumes that the selection of a person of the dominant religion to manage the Olympics is attributable to church interference in the decision-making process. In those circumstances, the old saying about paranoids, the less evidence of conspiracy makes more certain the fact that there is one, that can become widespread among the community. And believe me, in many of the communities of nones, it is becoming so. As a practical matter, where the dominant religion is highly organized down to the block level and has strong moral beliefs on many subjects of public concern, the leadership of the religion need not be involved formally, actively, in political life. The views of the dominant religion are going to be reflected by the overwhelming numbers of that religion being elected to public office. That's a fact of life in the Baptist South, once Catholic Boston, and places like the mythical town of Lake Wobegon in the Lutheran Midwest. The dominant church need not be active politically on many issues, because its views are going to be reflected in the decisions of government by virtue of its members being elected to most of the offices in government. It is simply assumed by the majority that everyone agrees with the decisions made, because it is further assumed everyone agrees with the views of the majority, belongs to the majority, or would like to if they only knew better. In Utah, it's even assumed that everyone belongs to the LDS Church or should be converted to membership in it. For the first few years of my residency in the state, I was often asked if I belonged to the church, a question one would not be asked anywhere else. Instead of saying none of your business, I politely replied, of course, how could one from my background not be a member of the one, the true, the universal Catholic Church? And when asked what ward I belonged to, I readily answered, none yet, but some of my family belonged to the 5th and Chauncey Street in Southie in Boston for at least 3 generations. I'll have to find out where I vote first before I know what ward I belong to. It's only after 5 or 6 years that I realized the ward was a religious entity and not a social or political one. It took another 5 years for me to realize that a ward in Utah was both a religious and a political one. There are significant differences in Utah from the religious dominance of other places, factors, I think, greatly magnifying the powers of the dominant church and the exclusion of nones beyond that which you might find in other places where there's a large percentage of people of one faith. One is that in no other state that I know of is the population so overwhelmingly of one religion. It is often estimated the population of Utah is 70% LDS. Other factors are the extent to which the organization of the religion is so much more pervasive in the daily lives of its members, and the extent to which a single political party has been so closely identified with that entity. Church seminaries adjacent to every school, activities for children like scouting are organized through the church, and many members find themselves working on one or another church activity each day of the week. The children of nones find their friends disappear around the 6th grade, and the children of nones often seek out other nones and form their own little groups for social activities, further dividing the school population in ways you don't see elsewhere. More often than not, many children of nones would find themselves excluded minorities in public schools from their own from social groups. They go off and attend private schools, which is a further division within the community that seems to be increasing. Adults also tend to be divided socially and politically, I think in part because many good LDS church members find themselves so occupied every day of the week. In 40 years, I've never been invited for a social event into the home of an LDS neighbor, and only on rare occasion have we gone out to dinner. And we have invited them to our house, good LDS members, and they're too busy, and I think honestly so. Although I consider many good members of the church to be close friends, I kind of feel sorry for them, having to work so hard or be so involved in the mission. But it is a factor that sort of makes a difference between Utah and elsewhere, and it's one that divides the community. Now, politically, one recent survey found that 56% of Mormon men and 48% of Mormon women consider themselves conservatives, while 25% of men and 36% of Mormon women consider themselves moderates. By my standard, probably means conservative to moderate Republicans elsewhere. Only 18.2% of the males and 15% of the women consider themselves liberal, probably mainstream or conservative Democrats elsewhere. I suspect we may have a large percentage of them in this meeting. One knowledgeable observer of the political scene in Utah believes that the political influence of the LDS Church has increased in recent years, not decreased, because of a shift in active church membership. In the past, the state was roughly divided into one-third active LDS, one-third inactive members, and one-third not members or nones in the state. Recent data indicates the population of the state is now 50% active church members, 1/6 inactive, and 1/3 not members of the LDS Church. I don't know how true that is, but Decker claims it is. Correspondingly, Republican political party strength has grown, as it has in other mountain states, over the past few decades, to the point where Republicans now outnumber Democrats by a 2-to-1 margin. The Republican Party is no doubt aware of the ideological advantage it has with the LDS Church. Vice President Quayle is purported to have once said, "Republicans understand the importance of the bondage between mother and child." He actually said that. I suspect the Republican Party, and if I were in their shoes, I would do the same, understands the importance of the bondage between the Republican Party and the LDS Church in Utah, no matter what the members or what the leadership of the church might think about that bondage. The current refusal of the Republican leadership in the legislature to consider the common sense suggestion by the president of the church to ban concealed weapons from schools and from churches may indicate that we are now seeing somewhat of a split taking place, and that maybe the Republicans are beginning to overlook the advantage they have had of identifying with their policies with those of the church. When it comes to guns in Utah, people appear willing to say, "The hell with anyone else, and we're devoted to our guns no matter what." The identification of the Republican Party and the church in the popular mind and vice versa is so close that you sometimes hear cautions by church leaders about the fact that you shouldn't use church property, church facilities, for political activity. And recently, an LDS church leader made the startling statement that it was okay for a church member to vote for a Democrat and stay in good standing with the church. And I don't think I would have heard that in any other state in the Union, with the possible exception of Idaho. Some Republican religious nones, people who are not LDS but good Republicans, many have told me they feel excluded from and do not take an active role in their party because they are religious nones. Political party meetings are often described as sounding like church meetings, where language unique to church meetings is used to articulate positions and debate in the political arena. The recent backlash against the conservative Eagle Forum attacking a political candidate, because of her sexual orientation indicates maybe there's some people out there in the community who aren't quite so identified between theological and political beliefs. They voted her into the office despite what was a pretty vicious attack. I think most of the nones I know of live in ghettos, essentially. I know I do. I live in a university ghetto, at a law school ghetto even, where you associate with a small group of people, do social events together, and have very little to do with the political, social, and other activities of the state. I think it's understandable for a church which has suffered persecution at the hands of government and the ostracism the LDS Church has suffered to be both concerned about and to be active in participating in state and national politics. It's surprising that it isn't as active as I think maybe that rationale would justify. Persecution by government because of the LDS Church's beliefs can make that any institution active, and has done so in many places in the world. Self-preservation can demand and justify a religion doing so, even though there is a significant risk of backlash between its members or within its membership and with nones for doing so. The record of the persecution of the LDS Church in the 19th century is unmatched by any other religion, at least in this country, if not in others. And if the members of the LDS Church were mostly Irish at the time of that persecution, the bombs and the bullets would still be flying. An accommodation with the federal government, as you all know, was made. The price of gaining statehood for Utah, a process that took 7 attempts, was more difficult than any other state. It was a process that required an accommodation to be made, and for Congress to be satisfied that a theocracy did not reign or would not reign in Utah. Church leaders practicing polygamy were jailed. The legal dissolution of the church was sought, and the seizure of church property by the federal government was threatened before the practice of polygamy was banned and before the federal government finally yielded and granted statehood. There were some added prices, however. One price was the inclusion of a probably unconstitutional ordinance, a really unique section in the Utah Constitution banning polygamy. The ordinance is part of Article 3 of the Utah Constitution, and it provides perfect toleration of religious sentiment is guaranteed. No inhabitant of this state shall ever be molested in person or property on account of his or her mode of religious worship, but polygamous and plural marriage are forever prohibited. Now, that part of the Utah Constitution is made irrevocable without the consent of the United States, a likely unconstitutional condition, because Utah is not in the Union on an equal footing with the other states, and hence past cases have said all states must be admitted on an equal footing, and conditions like this, which cannot be amended without the consent of the federal government, are unconstitutional because they violate what's called the equal footing doctrine. All of this is aside from any questions you might raise under the First Amendment about the legitimacy of a religious practice like polygamy. A concern over wedding church and state in Utah also resulted in a quite unique, it's not the only state, but one of the few, with this kind of an extensive list of constitutional prohibitions being included in the state constitution concerning the relationships of church and state. The state constitution prohibits the state from making any law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, aside from a few other things like speech and press. That's it for the feds, but not that's not it for Utah. It goes on. Any religious test from being required is prohibited as a qualification for any office of public trust or for any vote at any election. It prohibits the disqualification of any person as a witness or a juror on account of religious belief or the absence thereof. It prohibits any union of church and state. It prohibits any church from dominating the state or interfering with its function. And it prohibits the appropriation of any public money for or applied to any religious worship, exercise, or instruction, or for the support of any ecclesiastical establishment. It is a lengthy and rather impressive list of prohibitions, much more elaborate than you will find in the federal constitution and in the constitutions of most other states. It is a list of prohibitions many citizens in the state of Utah, even some lawyers, are unaware of because I think nobody's paid much attention to state constitutions until recent time. My initial introduction to Utah was with Governor Romney of Michigan in his constitutional convention in Michigan, where I was a young graduate student working on several projects rewriting the Michigan Constitution. So we went out and started reading state constitutions. They are really remarkable documents because they are based on the assumption that the state has all power and the function of the Constitution is to take power away from it, not to grant it and create a government. And hence, state constitutions tend to be much more lengthy, much more complex, and they read in some cases like the Internal Revenue Code. Well, for many years, there was no or relatively little litigation under those prohibitions of the Utah Constitution or under the federal prohibitions on interfering with free exercise or the Establishment Clause of the federal Constitution. I think one reason for the absence of litigation was the decision of LDS church leaders to refrain from explicit, active involvement in political affairs, except on issues the church identified as basic moral issues to it and to the community. So generally, over the years, there was not that much explicit kind of interference by church with state. Some issues, liquor by the drink, gambling, the Equal Rights Amendment, even a state flat tax, which would have eliminated the deduction for charitable contributions, all were debated, fought over, and some, to some degree, church involvement took place, and that increased the debate. But they were generally resolved in the legislature. More recently, actions in provoking LDS church political action have been those concerning basic religious beliefs about same-sex marriage, freedom of religion legislation in Congress, and this one may be a little bit far removed, locating the MX missiles just over the horizon from Salt Lake City. Although the remarkably religious and I think very divisive fighting that flared off often during the first 100 years of the territory subsided considerably, even with these issues floating around, the LDS Church and I think the citizens of the state still confront this problem of the political involvement, not so much of the church formally, but of the institutional beliefs of the church with government and with the moral affairs of the community. The basic question is, at what point does an issue justify involvement of a religion in its basic views in the affairs of the state? I believe every legal decision is a moral or ought decision. And it strikes me as simplistic to define the politically appropriate involvement of a church in the affairs of the state, define it and divide it from that which is inappropriate, on the grounds that one issue involves moral questions and another does not. Every legal issue involves moral questions. Ought we tax you more than someone else? The dividing line, I would suggest, ought to be circumstances where those holding beliefs unique to their religion seek to use the power of government to impose those beliefs on others without some generally accepted justification. Even where there is no such justification, it's legally and constitutionally permissible for a church to actively seek government action imposing its beliefs through government action. A church runs a high political and institutional risk if they do it, but nevertheless, they have the right to do it. The recent or the ongoing debate over the same-sex marriage issue in Hawaii, Alaska, and now California is an illustration of an issue where a church has every right to participate in that debate. It has every right to seek donations, although there may be a tax question, for that battle, but it's going to pay a price. I happened to be in San Francisco last Sunday, where the Sunday newspaper had one of the most bigoted and nasty editorial cartoons I have ever seen. And I've seen some Lulus, believe me. But this one was really nasty. It's talking about green jello and all kinds of things, and berating the LDS Church for stating its views, urging its members to participate in a debate upon the business of saints. The choice is that of the church. If it wants to become directly involved, it has to realize that it's going to encounter this kind of reaction, maybe most of the time not quite that nasty. Active political involvement in government by the LDS Church in Utah, I think, subsided quite a while ago on most issues. I trace it back to the marriage of the Salt Lake Tribune and the Deseret News when they formed the Newspaper Agency Corporation in 1952. To jointly print, distribute, and sell advertising in their previously competitive and very antagonistic newspapers. Sometime when you have a spare day or so, go read some of the back issues of both papers here. Some of the most vicious commentary, debate, and religious argument that you'll see anywhere. Others mark the decline, and they're probably more accurate since my objections to that marriage were based on antitrust principles rather than any others. Others mark the decline in the debate and the acrimony to accommodations being made to some degree over issues like liquor by the drink. That one sort of loosened, I think, the hostility of a lot of nones. Ending prayer in the public schools. And stopping the granting of high school credit for religion classes taken at LDS seminaries. I think other possible grounds for the decline or for the absence of any litigation or much litigation Over the first 100 years of the state of Utah and the territory of Deseret, really come down to the fact that many lawyers and citizens were not aware of these extensive prohibitions in the Utah Constitution, which outlawed some of these practices quite clearly that existed and now don't. Another reason, I think, and some lawyers from that time have told me this, is that they could not afford to take on this kind of a case. They would lose clients if they did. The ACLU, when I first came here, was made up of two university faculty members from the English department, one person from downtown, and Les Mazur and I, two people on the law faculty, drafted by the bar. Almost all of the cases were pretty horrendous criminal ones. There weren't all these left-wing challenges to this, that, or the other thing. And often lawyers would tell us, we just can't take on that case. If we do, we're going to lose clients, both criminal cases and cases involving church-state issues. I think also many citizens fear the risk of losing or being socially ostracized, if you will, if they became in that kind of a case. And the era of judicial liberalism seems to be in decline, at least at the federal level, and those kind of issues may not be as easy to take on as they were in the past. Nevertheless, despite all that, you can see a trend going on. Cases are starting to be brought challenging practices in Utah. I won't go through all of them, but just briefly, I think this is a product of excluded minorities who feel they can't get results from the executive and legislative branches of government. They turn to the courts or find some way to turn to the courts to seek relief for things they believe are unconstitutional, inappropriate activities. Recent cases included an attack on holding prayer at a local government meeting where a majority of the Utah Supreme Court upheld the practice on the ground that it was a historical one, sort of insulting to anybody that believes in prayer. But nevertheless, they upheld the practice and then attached very stringent conditions to its exercise, among which were everybody, all religions, all groups, political, economic, social, had to have an equal chance to say their prayer, and they had to do it by lot. And, of course, some communities wisely decided that's not worth the risk, and hence did not, or suspended or ended the practice. Murray City, by the way, did refuse to allow someone to say their prayer addressed to Our Mother who art in heaven. If indeed there is a heaven, and if there is a God that takes a woman's way, it goes on and on. That case was litigated, and the Tenth Circuit in that case upheld the city's action, but I'm not sure that would have floated in the Utah courts. Conditions imposed by the court as a practical matter ended the practice in most communities of any size and diversity, but not all. For some people, ending prayer at city council meetings is almost as revolutionary as ending prayers in school. If paranoids didn't have enough to deal with, given the coming new millennium, the Y2K computer program or problem, ending prayers at Salt Lake City Council meetings has now been added to the brew, and I've had one tell me that we're going to have Armageddon because of it. Now, not surprisingly, one area that really inflames people are church-state cases in the context of public school activities. And they really can be very hot and heated, particularly in a community where there's an overwhelming or dominant religious group. Exclusion of one's children from normal school activities or the use of public schools to impart or impose the beliefs of the dominant religious group on others are real flashpoints in any American community whenever they occur. These are the disputes that are going to deeply divide the nons from the non-nons, because they involve the exclusion of some from the activities of all, the education of every child on an equal basis, and the use of state power, a silly ban, or what I think is a silly ban, on all extracurricular clubs rather than suffer the presence of a few. A few probably would have died if they were ignored. One such case involved a claim that a school choir was being used to propagate religious beliefs. the majority of the courts struck down, or the majority of the court found that that did not take place, but nevertheless, it really divided the community involved very deeply and resulted in very, I think, extensive and expensive litigation. Now, one issue, the constitutionality of official prayers at invocations or at graduation ceremonies, was also litigated in Utah. Court upheld the right to do it. Thereafter, the United States Supreme Court struck down the practice, and hence prayer is no longer permitted at graduation. And it was a practice in Utah, I know, that caused many nuns, religious nuns, to refuse to attend their high school graduation. They felt ostracized throughout high school by virtue of being nuns to begin with, and after enduring several years of exclusion from normal childhood experiences, they saw this action at a high school graduation, whether you think it meaningful or not, they saw it as the ultimate insult and did not attend. In fact, some of them had a party at our house once on the day of their graduation where they thought that it was a time of relief since they no longer were going to be suppressed in their high school life, and they were getting away from something they really resented a great deal. In Boston, I'm sure most of the Catholics would think nothing of it. In the Baptist South, I'm sure most of them would think nothing of it. But I think we all have to recognize treating children or excluding children and making them into small cliques or groups that are excluded from the activities of all is a very, very dangerous, if not a very sad thing to do. So what is the state of church and state in Utah today? I don't think it's one of hostility of one for the other. That's pretty clear. Or at least hostility between the LDS church and the state. I think it's more a case of homogenization of the LDS church, the Republican Party, and the state. But it's a homogenization without a complete pasteurization. A lot of nuns still around. And I think some of them are becoming more and more paranoid, if you want, angry, if you want, because there seems to be more and more decisions made without any proper process being followed. I'm not so sure it's the substance of the decisions being made. For example, I think I would have gone and testified that Temple Square should be made into Temple Rectangle that stopped more cars from coming into the city and provided a beautiful green space. I think I might have even supported restrictions on people, you know, associating or walking around an area that the LDS Church considers its headquarters and doing things that perhaps shouldn't be done around a church. Vatican Square, I'm sure, has similar restrictions. Nobody debated these. Bang, it was done. And boom, the explosion occurred. I think a growing number of citizens and lawyers are willing to take on some of these issues, not through the ballot box. A lot of them are discouraged about that. They're taking them to court where it's more expensive and where it's perhaps more divisive than even in the political realm. So paradoxically, it may be time for some intervention in politics by the church to help strike a new balance of political power in the state between Democrats and Republicans, religious nuns and non-nuns, by recognizing no political party has the right answers to all the issues which concern or ought to concern society. I'm not sure they would take a position, which I would hope most churches would take, on religious issues as well, that we don't have all the answers. Too many churches think they do. It's certainly well past the time for political leaders to open up the processes of government, cease strong-arm political tactics, foreclosing public debate, and stop being insensitive to the views and concerns of those who are nuns, religious and political. The present circumstances are not as good as they could be for either church and state. I think in Utah they pose some long-term risks for both. And hence are worth your attention. But then there may be some hope, another penetrating insight attributed to that eternal optimist Dan Quayle, offers the hope for both nons and non-nons alike. The future will be better tomorrow. I am open to any questions. I knew Ed had a guess. I'm not so sure. Professor Kimball asks whether, even if we opened up debate, given the dominance of one religion or one political party, the results would change at all. I think it might. And one thing it's going to do, it's going to co-opt the nones if you give them a fair shake. I've always insisted, for example, whether it's selecting a university president, a dean, or whatever, you start off with a faculty-student committee. Or have them recommend names. Then if something goes wrong, they can't scream about it. But let me give you a little example. A few years back, I was chairing a university committee on speech standards on the University of Utah campus. You may recall there were shanties built up there which sat around for a year. And all of a sudden, the president of the university ordered them to be torn down. And all of a sudden, what was a dying issue suddenly blossomed into this big free speech issue. Went to the federal courts, and of course the federal judge says you can't enter that order, you don't have any standards and all that. So Chase Peterson asked me to chair this committee, and I said, fine, Chase, I'll do it so long as I can select the committee members. And he said, well, that's pretty unusual. I said, yeah, Chase, but listen to me. Let me do this. I'm Irish. I'm from Boston. I know how to play politics. So I went out and I selected people from the right and from the left, people from the community. Cal Rampton was on it. Hippies, you could, about 15 or so, every possible political spectrum. And we met for 3 months. And over time, they started to like each other. And we came up with a really good set of speech regulations that went into effect. That group even had a reunion a year later. They did. Went out to dinner together. But the point I was going to make is that the very first case to come up under those regulations was a little old lady who wanted to march from the park building to the medical center with a sign protesting the way animals were being treated and animal testing in the university medical center. And the fellow that was in charge of administering these had turned down her application. And he called me up. He said, I don't feel comfortable, but I don't think a non-university person should be permitted to do that. I said, you don't have any choice. You know, she has a constitutional right to do that. He said, well, she may cause trouble. I said, she's 80 years old or 70 years old. I said, look, grant her the permit, and if you're worried, walk with her. He called me up 2 days later. He said, you know, the way the university is treating those animals up there is not really... So, you know, you're right in one sense, but I think if you have open debate, for example, 30 years ago I wrote an article suggesting we get rid of an elected attorney general. And the reasons for it, I think, are pretty obvious, management of the executive branch of government. Today I don't think I would favor it. Why? Because of the way this was done. It gives rise to the argument that you'll have strong political power being waged without someone up there listening to the other side. I still think it ought to be done, ultimately. Absolutely. Oh, those were the wild days, huh? Yeah, I think, Decker, I don't want to try to misrepresent Rod's views, but Rod said, the Republicans have been mostly dominant in the state of Utah, except from the time of the Depression through World War II and into the 50s or so, and then things started to shift. I don't know if that's an accurate representation of his views, but nevertheless, I think that's probably true throughout the Mountain West, Intermountain West. I read another piece recently suggesting that a lot of conservative business types who made their money in California have moved out, moved to states like Utah and Idaho and Montana, and whereas a lot of people from south of the border have moved into California, therefore resulting in California being more liberal and democratic and these states being more conservative. I don't pretend to be a political science expert, but I do think if you look at it historically, there's much more identity, let's say, between the moral values promoted by the LDS Church and those of the Republican Party, particularly after the 50s, 60s period, when Democrats became identified with being, you know, total libertines on just about every issue and offended their constituencies in the South, the Baptist constituency, the blue-collar worker constituency, as well as in states like this. So I'm not a political science expert by long shot. Yes? You're a non?
Non, yes.
Non. I know what you're going to talk about.
His genius was he didn't care about any issue. He was powerful. And then as I come back to the
Your question is it power that politicians are concerned? Sure, certainly some are. So your observation, I guess it's an observation for the record, is that it's power that politicians care for, not religion. That wasn't really my point. It's whatever, wherever the power is, and I think power has to be somewhere to set standards by which we all live, the power has an effect on people in the community. And that effect can, of course, be one that's constructive or destructive. Right now, I think that a lot of the decisions that nons see are not being supported. They're being interpreted, perhaps wrongly, but nevertheless being interpreted as being a mixing of church and state. I don't know how many people I've heard talk about, you know, closing off Main Street. And all of a sudden, you know, it's not a discussion of the traffic patterns or any of that. It was a takeover by the church. I've heard good church members say that, usually ones that have had their commute extended another 5 minutes or whatever. But, you know, it's an automatic assumption. And that breeds, I think, a divisiveness in the community and bigotry in the community that can be very dangerous and not good for all of us. That's my basic point.
Yes, sir? We're out of time, so let me encourage you to talk to John afterwards or out of the hall or something, but I know there'll be another group coming in. Let's get John.